So I'm excited to be here. It's a nice room, and I'll be teaching you first part of the quantum theory, which is the non-relativistic part. And this is a very famous picture. Can anyone tell me about this picture? Probably would have seen a number of times. You should be able to recognize few of them here. It was taken in...
It's the
fifth Solvia conference, and it's really considered important for the future of quantum theory. We do quantum theory today. It's considered to be one of the, let's say, stepping stone for the quantum theory which we know today. So I really like this picture, and it has a number of famous scientists who are contributors to this theory, and I think there were 22 or 29, I don't know exact participants, but out of them, I think 17, they were Nobel awardees, or they were awarded Nobel Prize after the conference. So it was a really important conference where they not only discussed the advancement in quantum theory, but they also debated over the various interpretations of quantum theory. Okay, and we'll get back to that in this lecture. So a brief introduction, that's customary, I guess. You all know my name. If you have a hard time pronouncing it, I understand. You can just call me Aurora, which is much easier pronunciation. Office number, just down the hall, 265. If I'm not in my office, I'm somewhere, definitely somewhere in PI. I like to work in Bistro or in Reflection Lounge or something. So just email me, you drop me a message, I'll be there. Or if you have any questions, you can just email me your questions or email me to arrange for a meeting, and we can do that anytime. Teaching assistant is here. So hi, Serkan. And he was one of the Psi fellows,
yes.
Psi students. And kindly introduce yourself as well.
Yeah, my name is Sarjan, and I was a Psi student last year, so I'm really excited to see you all here, like new people in this room. Also, my office is now, like I said, it's 356. You can also email me, and I guess the email would be like listed in the course website.
Yes, it's the more details are listed on the course outline, okay, which is on the Psi portal.
My office. I'm gonna guide you through the tutorials with me here.
Yes. So half of the lecture content is by Dan, and he's going to talk about introduction to scalar quantum field theory, Feynman diagram techniques for perturbation theory, and he's an amazing teacher. More information with the tentative schedule, like what we are going to do with the lectures and tutorials, what topics we are going to cover, is on the Psi portal. There's a course website called Quantum Theory 2023. I'm sure Dan is going to talk about the course requirement in more detail today or maybe tomorrow with the orientation. But just to give you a brief, that you need to complete all the quizzes, which I don't intend to, but Dan has a couple of quizzes which are on the Psi portal, so you should be completing those quizzes. Also attend and participate all the tutorials in person. If you are not planning to attend, like for some reason you can't attend it in person, online is an option as well, but the main purpose of tutorials is collaborative work, and online doesn't work so well. If you are not at all attending tutorial, you must either notify me or Sarjan about missing a tutorial in advance. And as a compensatory, you should also submit the work for the tutorial done. You should just submit some solution of the tutorial, okay? Homework problems should be submitted. That's a course requirement. And this year, the homework policy, submission policy has changed a little bit, which I'll give you a brief. Homework should be submitted online on the Psi portal. And then there will be a final interview after the course where you'll be asked to demonstrate some understanding of the key concepts and some like trivial calculations. So the homework policy now has three deadlines, which wasn't there before. And it's pretty strict this year. And three deadlines, they are approximately 2 weeks apart so that you can submit, and then you can get feedback on your homework submissions. There are no extension possible for the first two deadlines. And if your work is satisfactory after the first submission, you're good to go. You don't have to submit it for the like the second and the third submissions are not necessary. But if your solutions are not satisfactory, then you'll be given a feedback and then you'll have to resubmit it after the first deadline. The third deadline is strict in the sense that in case you need extension, you need a very valid reason for the extension and you have to go through a process, which Dan probably is going to tell you about how to go about that. But I really recommend you that submit your homeworks before the second deadline or maybe just after the second deadline. Don't wait for the third hard deadline. And good thing about submission would be that you'll be able to get the feedbacks if you submit. So if, like, for example, you don't have anything done for the first deadline, at least submit something, okay? Okay, so last year I taught this course and I got feedback which said that most of the course content students had already covered. So this year I had to change the content considerably, and when I was thinking what should be the actual course content for a new class, which is just arriving, related to quantum theory, I thought why not put some things which is going to be part of your psi courses ahead. So this course might be too trivial for some, like few topics would be too trivial. You might have seen extended topics and some of the topics might not be too trivial and you are seeing it for the first time. So I guarantee you that for some topics, it might seem easier for you, but there's definitely something for everyone here. So there are some things which you might be seeing it for the first time. So I really hope you enjoy this. And briefly, the lectures. I'm going to cover 7 lectures. Today's lecture would be more about building the basics of quantum theory. And while in that process, we'll talk about some quantum bizarre phenomena, very interesting ones, okay? Second lecture would be about the time dynamics of quantum systems, and we are going to talk about at least 4 approaches to do that. So second lecture will cover the Schrodinger and Heisenberg approach, and we'll talk about some new concepts like the quantum revivals, and how can we explain block sphere on Schrodinger and Heisenberg picture. I think that would be the part of your tutorial, the block sphere exercise. Fourth lecture would be for the quantum information enthusiasts. So yesterday, a lot of people said that they're interested in quantum information. So this part of the lecture is kind of building basics for the upcoming quantum information course in the Psi program. The third lecture would be another approach, which would be the interaction picture. And we'll discuss some standard textbook topics like the Fermi golden rule, but I'll try to give a little different perspective for the interaction picture. Okay, and I think most of you might have covered the Schrodinger-Heisenberg picture during your undergrad, but interaction picture might be new for at least a few of you. Fifth lecture would be the introduction of path integral formulation, which would be used in your QFT courses. And I'm not going to talk about the operator approach. It's just going to be the path integral approach that we are going to talk about. It might be new for a couple of you at least, I guess. Sixth lecture, we are going to try to build the concept of fields from particles, which was like first 5 lectures. And then in the 7th lecture, we are going to talk about more interesting phenomena like how actually particles, they come into existence and how the forces can be explained and so on, okay? And special thanks to Vipul, who is sitting there. He really helped me in developing the course content and all the animations and visualizations you are going to see in each of the lectures. The most important slide throughout the lecture, how to ask questions. And it's really important. Not because I guarantee you that I'm going to answer each and every of your question, but when you ask question, it helps you, I know, but it helps me as well. Like if I am able to answer, good, but if I'm not able to answer, I need to learn something which is really good for my development. So there are three ways you can ask. Raise your hand, ask question. The other way is, like, each lecture is going to have a Slido. I know it's a new group and you're not still comfortable with each other. So if you want an anonymous question to be asked, just log in here. You can use your cell phones or any devices. Just scan it. You can ask your anonymous questions, and those questions will appear at the back, okay? So I'll just keep track of any questions which is coming on way. So don't hesitate. This is the second mode. Did you all scan it for today's lecture? At the end of the lecture, I'll give you like 2-3 minutes to hand out handwritten like Google forms where you can ask questions, but that's not the purpose of those forms. The purpose is to give a summary, like 3-4 line summary of the lecture. What's your main takeaway from the lecture? It helps me understand better, like, how much did you understand and what did you understand what I was trying to convey or not. Okay, so that would be in the end of each lecture. Okay, so I think that's the basic introduction which I wanted to start with. That was important. Any questions related to whatever we have discussed?
When does homework be assigned?
My homework, the first homework, I plan to do it after 2 weeks so that we have at least covered considerable amount of, so expected by the next weekend. Not this one, but the next one. And I think Dan would have 1 or 2 homeworks as well. Any other questions if you have? Okay, great. So let's start. Okay, so what we are going to do, as I said, in this lecture is we are going to try to build the basics of quantum theory and also look at some very nice quantum phenomena. And when we are trying to build this quantum theory, any theory, not just quantum, any theory is based on the observations, right? When you build a theory, it should support the observations. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. And that's true for quantum theory as well. You're trying to explain the quantum particles. And based on the observations, we know that quantum particles, they are always observed as individuals. You never observe them as waves, right? They're all observed as an individual particle. And you always observe a whole quantum particle. It's never that you see a quarter or a fraction of an electron. It's always observed as complete. And they're all same. So electron in this part of the universe is exactly same to the electron in any other part of the universe, right? Do you agree? And this is a question which really amazes me. Like, how? Not even a tiniest difference. Theoreticians, like, I'm an atomic physicist who work with precise atomic calculations, and we are trying to find if we find some kind of variations in these fundamental constants like electron mass or fine structure constant and so on. And so far, we haven't been able to find any variation in all these constants. So they are really constants and they are all the same. And a very interesting observation related to these quantum particles is that their trajectories are not predictable. So you have an experimental apparatus. You shoot an electron or quantum particle. You see where it, like on the screen where it hits. You repeat the exact experiment with same conditions. It might hit at any other point on the screen, right? So their trajectories are not predictable. However, what is predictable or what has pattern is the quantum density, like these probability densities. So you can predict at what, like with what probability is going to land at one point. Okay, so I give you a point and then you can tell me, okay, this is the probability that is going to hit on the screen at this point, okay? So you always see patterns in the probabilities, but not in the trajectories for these quantum particles. And whenever we talk about probabilities, what comes into my mind is the interference, because that's the first undergrad experiment which we talk about with probability densities. And so I'll start with this code, which says, like Richard Feynman, and it's a very famous code, that double slit experiment has in it heart the heart of quantum mechanics. And in reality, it contains the only mystery. So if, I would say that if you're able to understand the double slit experiment, you can actually understand quantum physics. And nobody does understand the double slit experiment so well. So nobody understands the quantum mechanics so well. It lies in the, I would say it's the cornerstone of quantum theory. And you can build the entire quantum theory using this experiment. That's what we are going to do in today's lecture. Like standard textbooks, if you see, most of these standard textbooks, they start with Stern-Gerlach to build the quantum theory. But we can do equally well with the interference double slit as well, okay? So let's build quantum theory using our double slit experiment, and I'm not assuming you remember that, probably you do, but the basic idea was with waves, we have seen that there's a pattern in the maximas and minimas over the screen, and so on, a brief history. It was first performed by Thomas Young, and he was reported in year 1801 to Royal Society of London. And he did it with light, and we saw fringes of bright and like dark spots on the screen. The explanation was given that light is a wave, so when it passes through slits, it splits into two, and each wave, it interferes with each other, and the points, just the way the water waves do, and the point where you have maxima sitting is the point of brightness, and when you have a minima and a maxima are the points of the dark spots. Okay. But this is not the actual experiment which Feynman had suggested. So he suggested that if we can build the double slit experiment with particles, single particles, which we'll come to, would give us so much information about how quantum world works. Okay. Before going into the single particle model, the experiment was repeated with particles like electrons, and the basic setup, it consisted of a light source, which could be thought of as electron source, and then the slit, S1 and S2, just shoots like these particles. They come and then they meet on the screen. The screen has a number of detectors, and each detector counts how many electrons hit on the screen. So you collect the data, draw a histogram, and you can see that as a function of time, as a function of the position, you get an interference pattern, okay? And in tutorials, we are going to not see the probability distribution for the position, but the probability distribution for momentum. And they should be related because they are related to through the uncertainty principle, okay? All right, so the experiment was done with particles and quantum particles, and it was seen that they show the same behavior as the waves do. They build a quantum interference pattern. And this is a very interesting article where you can build your own interference pattern at home. It's a do-it-yourself. And it also talks about other experiments like which way and quantum erasers, which we are going to do today, okay? So it's a very interesting article if you're interested in, you can have a look. Okay, so if you close one of the slits, your double slit pattern is lost, the interferences are lost. What you get is a Gaussian or a diffraction pattern. And the basic idea is that if the particles are having the information for both the slits, you get an interference pattern. If, however, you force them to move through one slit, the interference pattern is lost, okay? So this is the takeaway from the single slit and double slit patterns. Now, possible interpretations could be that you have number of particles, some passing through the first slit, the other passing through the second slit, and then interfering and making an interference pattern. This could be one of the possible interpretations, right? Because you're doing it with the number of particles. Other could be that each particle is interacting with both the slits. So it's one particle which is interacting with both the slits and then producing an interference pattern. in order to see which of the physical interpretations are actually correct, the experiment had to be done using a single particle. Okay, and that's what done. That's what the initial proposal by Feynman, to do it with single particles, and that wasn't done until I think 1872. And then there have been numerous of experiments. Not that it's a dead field. I saw a paper in 2023, which was revisiting into this double slit experiment. So it's not a dead field where people are not still interested in. And few references are on the notes, which are on the SCI portal. If you want to have a look, you can see them. Okay, so the experiment was done with single photon, single particle, and to our amaze, we still get a interference pattern, which means that the particle was kind of interacting with both the slits. So till now, the particles are kind of showing a behavior similar to waves, right? You have a wave, it splits at the slits, interacts, splits into two waves, interacts, like interfere with each other, and produces the interference pattern. And this is something which appears to be happening for single particles as well, right? Well, the only difference is that the waves, when they are detected on the detector screen, all the detectors, they like kind of switch on simultaneously. However, particles, they are detected as a whole. So one particle coming, and then it falls on the screen at one point. Second particle coming, falls on the screen at second point. So that's the only difference. But it somehow seems to be behaving or producing this interference pattern the way waves would do. So in order to test that is it that the particle is moving through both the slits, or it's just moving through one of the two slits? Experiments were done, like proposed, theoreticians had proposed some experiments to test whether this was true or not. And what does this say? It says that the particles have wave behavior and they're interacting with both the slits S1 and S2. So some kind of superposition was built from this thing. And we needed to test if these particles, they were actually passing through both, like a single particle passing through both the slit. Doesn't make sense, but we needed some experiment, some proof that this was or was not happening. And something which is called a which way apparatus was, I would say, experiment was proposed. I don't exactly remember what year it was performed first, but it was a very interesting experiment, which, like for example, in the case of photons, which could be seen in a very simple form here. So this is a very, I would say, a simplified version of how the actual experiment was done, but just for explanation purpose, just to get the concept. If let's say we have a photon and we want to see which out of which two paths it actually passed through, okay? Which slit it passed through, or it passed through both the slits. We need some kind of detectors here, right? There's a detector here on the screen which detects the particle, which is absorbs the particle. We need detectors here as well, which can detect whether the photon passed from S1 or photon passed from S2 or photon passed from both. And these detectors should be very sensitive, in the sense the detectors on the screen are the detectors which are absorbing. So they're kind of not letting the particles pass through them. Okay, that's why you're seeing this pattern, like interference or diffraction pattern on the screen. The detectors here are special kind of detectors, that's what we need, which let the particles pass, yet they give us information that the particle passed through that, right? You don't want the particles to be absorbed here. You won't get an interference pattern. So you need special kind of detectors which don't absorb the particle. So I won't call them as detectors. Some literature, they call them as detectors, and it's often termed as the weak measurement. I don't understand the exact phenomenon of weak measurement. I don't believe there should be something called weak measurement. So I'll call them as markers, okay? I won't call them as detectors, but markers. So let's say we have two polarizers, horizontal and vertically polarized polarizers. If my particle passed through S1, it is horizontally polarized. And if my particle passes through S2, it's vertically polarized. So I have kind of markers on their head, all right? And when they are detected on the screen, I would know which polarization they were. So I'll know which screen, which slit they came from, all right? And when such kind of an experiment was tried to see which out of which two slits the particle went through, the interference pattern was lost. Didn't get any interference pattern at all. So kind of building another postulate of quantum mechanics, which says that if you try to observe the system, you destroy the superposition, right? So this is the kind of interference pattern. This is the kind of pattern which you'll expect if it was coming through one slit. And that's true, okay? This is a diffraction pattern. This is a Gaussian. So if you're trying to see which out of these two slits it's coming, you're kind of disturbing the system, disturbing the quantumness, and you don't see the particle in superposition, the interference pattern is lost. Mathematically, yeah.
In the previous picture, in the previous slide, I was wondering if it will have a single peak or two peaks.
It will have two. That's a good question. Yeah. It will have two peaks, but both the Gaussians would be like overlapping.
Oh.
And the peaks would be I think the peaks would be separated by the distance between the slits, which is like very small. So you won't be able to distinguish. So basically, to your eye, it'll look as a single peak, but actually, it's from both horizontal and vertical, like two peaks. No. What we mean here is that we have kind of marked which path they come from. And if we have marked which path they come from, they shouldn't be in the superposed state. Okay, it's not that polarization has canceled at the end.
So I assume this has been done to, like, there's nothing special about horizontal and vertical, right? So
it has been done, yeah. So this is a very simplified version of the actual experiments.
So takeaway is that, like, measurement destroys the quantum. Right?
Yes, whenever you try to observe, it destroys the quantum superposition. Okay, so this is how, and this slide is important for your tutorial. So it's just that you have kind of marked which slit it came from. If it came from S1, it has been horizontally polarized. If it came from S2, it was vertically polarized, okay? I'll ask a question now. What if, maybe I should go back to the slide. Okay, so in this picture here, horizontal and vertical polarization. What if I use horizontal polarization? Like polarizers, what do you expect? So instead of a vertical polarizer, I use same polarizers here. The interference pattern should reappear, right? Because now you don't know which slit it came from. Let's say I have a minus H polarizer here. So H here and a minus H here. Minus H means like linear and anti-linear, something like that. What do you expect? Do you expect to see interference pattern, or you don't expect to see an interference pattern?
What's the difference between H and minus H?
So it's a linearly, like instead of H, you use a linear polarizer and an anti-linear polarizer.
Can you detect on the depth of which one's linear, which one's anti-linear?
Probably, yeah. Let's say yes. I don't know how, but. Okay. So you tricked me into that, but let's say. Let's say I'm not able to detect, I don't know. I mean, should we be able to detect if it came from like linear or anti-linear polarizers?
The way that I think about polarizers is just a slit, so I don't know what linear or anti-linear means. Like, how does it?
So there's some polarization differences between, so maybe I can answer it this way. Let's say I have two different polarizers here, and I can tune the polarization, difference in the polarization angle, okay? So this is zero, let's say it's a linearly polarized, and there I have another polarizer, which is, I'm tuning the angle So now if I tune it to minus 180 degree, that's what I mean with by the anti-polarizer, if that's the correct term. So this is a small simulation which will help us see how the interference pattern changes with the difference in the polarization angle. Yep.
What is the polarization initial state before it
gets? I'm assuming they are all same polarized, maybe linearly polarized. That's really important, yeah. They can't be in like random polarization.
Okay.
So this is something which we just saw, right? So this theta one, can you see the angles? Is the text large enough? Okay. So this is my polarizer H. Let's say it's a linear polarizer, so theta is zero. And this is my polarizer V, which is orthogonal to my linear polarizer. And if I have that, see that I don't see any interference pattern here. Okay, just ignore theta 3, that will come in our, I think, fourth or fifth slide from now. But yeah, so you don't see any interference pattern because you know which slit, you have already marked which slit it came from. If both the polarizers were aligned, you see an interference pattern. But if I slowly change the phase, like the polarization difference, you see the interference pattern is not lost all of a sudden. You do see, like, for example, if I say I keep the angle 45, I see the peaks, the location of the interference peaks, they are still the same. The exposition hasn't changed. It's the amplitude which has changed. So it's like kind of decreasing with the angle. And what's more interesting is that after 90, like after this, after a Gaussian, if I increase the difference more, the pattern reemerges, but now I see anti-fringes. So wherever you had maxima for zero case, you have a minima here. Okay, so I'll call this as interference pattern. And let me show you screenshots of the various angles. So here are the screenshots. So this is no difference in polarization angle, 45, 75, interference pattern. Peaks are at the same point. It's the amplitude which is decreasing and appearance of anti-fringe patterns. I'll give you, I'll make a statement here which is going to be useful in your tutorials, okay? Just keep in mind, it's not related to what I'm going to cover in my topics ahead. But what's important to note here is that if you overlap fringes and anti-fringes, what do you expect to get? So if you have a fringe and an anti-fringe pattern and you overlap, it becomes a Gaussian. So this is something that's a tip, that's a hint, which will be useful for today's tutorial, okay? So I would say all these thought experiments, like which way, initially are thought experiments, which experimentalists with their wonderful technological development, they actually can do that. And once they're able to do all these experiments, they move a step forward, always. That's always almost always have happened. So for this case as well, experimentalists thought, is there a way to get back the interference pattern? And I think this experiment, which is called a quantum eraser experiment, was first done, I don't remember the year, but the experimentalist group in University of Maryland. What they did, they inserted a depolarizer, so it's a 45 degree polarizer, between screen and our earlier polarizers. And what they saw was, the interference pattern reemerges. And what they called was a quantum eraser. Why? Because a particle coming, moving through HNV, it now knows, particle knows which slit it came from, right? That's what is happening. It knows it came from S1 or S2, moves, hits a D, it completely forgets which slit it came from. Doesn't make sense, right? Because interference pattern is a signature that the particle doesn't know which slit it came from. It's in superposition. How come till here the particle knew which slit it came from, and after D, its memory was erased and it didn't know which slit it came from? Okay, so such experiments are called quantum erasers, and there's a plethora of experiments which have been done with it. And again, it's a very simplified schematic of the actual experiments.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Is it related to the specific angle that they chose for the third one? Because it kind of cancels the effect of the first two markers that we put there.
So you're moving ahead to tutorials?
Sorry?
So you're actually moving forward. This is something which we are going to see in tutorials.
Oh.
It doesn't make sense, right?
Yeah.
It's perplexing to me. It doesn't make sense. And it doesn't, actually. So whatever I'm saying is not true. In tutorial today, what I'm teaching you, you'll have to unlearn that. So whatever you're learning in the lectures, you'll have to unlearn. So there's definitely a misconception here, which we need to solve. Okay, let's keep it for tutorials.
Wait,
okay?
That's correct on the screen.
Yes, for lectures.
Okay.
But at the end of the lectures, this is, okay, I'll say something like that. Okay, I'm a big fan of Star Wars.
Sure.
So there's a very famous saying by Yoda. I don't know exactly, but it said something like, you understand things the way you want to understand. Something here. Sometimes some phenomena, like quantum physics, has always been so weird. Entanglement, superposition, which you don't actually have a counter, like you don't have an intuitive intent feel about all these stuff. Some phenomena like this, again, is like a wow thing, a quantum phenomena which is not explainable or something, but that's not always true. And we'll see that in tutorial, that this is explainable. It's not like it's a quantum bizarreness which we are talking about. But you're just killing the entire suspense. Let's move step by step, and yeah.
Just to clarify, like, this is a real experiment, these are the actual results.
Yes, that's what experimentalists, they claim, oh, this is a quantum eraser. But then we come into picture, theoreticians, which say, oh, this is what you're missing about. Okay, that's what we are going to see. As theoreticians here, we are going to resolve that mystery. Because this doesn't make sense, and I'll tell you why. Experimentalists, they don't stop here. They move one step ahead, okay? What they proposed was, and this is just how you are going to do it in tutorials, okay? When you put a depolarizer, you'll have a projector, like depolarizer is kind of measuring the polarization, so you'll have a projection of a D. I mean, I'm missing a ket vector there, okay? But anyways. So just to say that it has so much paradox aligned to it, the concept. Theoreticians or experimentalists, I don't know who first proposed, but there was a proposal called the delayed choice proposal, which said, okay, so I have I have a depolarizer. What if the decision that I insert this depolarizer is made after the interference pattern has been obtained? What would happen? Doesn't make sense in this apparatus. What you need is kind of entangled systems to do that experiment. But that was the basic idea, the basic question they asked. What if the decision to erase the memory was taken after the interference pattern was produced on the screen? And this is what is called the delayed choice experiment, okay? I'll spend some amount of time on this experiment, just first explaining, because it looks different from the previous schematics, and then we'll discuss what the delay choice means, okay? So, light source, slits, and then you have something called splitting crystal, special kind of crystal which produces entangled system. So you have a photon coming here, and then when it passes through the crystal, emerges out, it's broken into two photons, okay? And they are entangled. They have anticorrelation. So if one is in vertical polarization, the other would be in horizontal, okay? This process is called parametric down conversion, and there are special crystals which can produce entangled photons. I think the most widely used is the BBO crystal. It's something like barium, I don't remember the name, but it's like BBO crystal, so there's an incoming photon and it breaks into two entangled, okay? I'll probably use a pointer. Okay. So you have two photons coming from, let's say, or a photon coming from S1, S2, whatever, but when a photon passes through this crystal, it produces two entangled pairs. So one pair goes through the top of the experimental apparatus, and it's directed towards the detector screen, where we are going to see the pattern, interference or diffraction. The other photon, it is transferred to the markers, okay? And whatever, so by entanglement, I'll give you a very naive definition, which is just required here. Entanglement has to its own like mystery. It's a topic which requires an entire lecture in itself. But by entanglement, what I mean here is that if you're making some effect here, it's going to cause effect your other particle as well. Okay. So the photon which is directed towards the screen, we are going to call as the source photons. So let me write that. So source to detector screen. And the photon which is directed towards the markers, we'll call them as the idlers. Okay. So we have two photons. Two source photons coming from the photons from slit 1 and 2, producing an interference pattern, and two idler photons again coming from S1 and S2, and they are entangled to these two photons here, okay? The apparatus here, it has some new optical components. Let's see what they are. So these are just the horizontal and vertical polarizers, which we saw earlier, and these are beam splitters. So what does beam splitter optically, like optical beam splitter, they do is they break your incoming photon's probability into the photon being transmitted or being reflected, okay? So a photon coming from here is going to split the probability of photon being transmitted or being reflected. And if it's being reflected, it'll be detected at DH, which is like, it'll say that, oh, it came from horizontally polarized light, like it's from the slit 1. And for vertical, again, this beam splitter 2 is going to divide the probability of this photon into being detected here. And the transmitted ones are going to pass through a third marker, which was our diagonally polarized marker. And if it came from here, it's the detector D is going to be clicked, okay? So these are detectors which are being clicked, and we are kind of noting the reading, which detector it came from, okay? Now, if my detector DH and DV clicks, it means I have the information for the slit it's coming from. So I should see what kind of pattern here? Interference or the Gaussian? I should see a Gaussian. if these two, in, if any of these two detectors they clicked. But if DH clicked, I should see an interference pattern. That's what we saw. Okay. And what I missed in my previous slide was that it perfectly makes sense to replace this D polarizer with minus D polarizer. And if you do that, instead of the interference pattern with fringes, you'll see an interference pattern with anti-fringes. Okay? So if you replace D by minus D, it'll still produce an interference pattern. You don't know which slit it came from, but the pattern would be just composed of anti-fringes. All right? Okay. So far, so good. I don't see any problem with that. Now, in order to do this delay choice, let's say the optical length of this part of the experimental apparatus is longer than the optical path of this part of the experimental apparatus. Okay? So the photon, the source photons, they hit the screen, produce the interference pattern before the decision to use HV marker, which is like which way, or the decision to use H, V, and D markers, which is like quantum eraser. The decision is made after the interference pattern is made. Okay? Any questions with the experimental apparatus or what's going on here? Yeah?
What's the necessity of the lenses?
Oh, the lenses just to make the interference pattern. There's nothing physics about that. Yeah, that's just the part of experimental apparatus.
So the above screen is farther than HV,
no.
Or?
This is farther.
Yeah, starting from H, okay.
So it's like it's about 8 seconds of gap experimentally, the experiments which have been performed. These detectors, they click after 8 seconds, this detector is clicked. Okay? Yeah.
So the colors, they say that what particles are entangled. So the red color, the red beams are the entangled pairs, right?
Yes. So red means entangled pairs, blue means entangled pairs. Red means coming from slit S1, blue means coming from slit S2.
And you said that when they are getting entangled, we know what's the, like one of them is horizontally polarized and one of them is vertically.
The entangled pair which I'm taking is a singlet kind. So it's like the overall polarization should be zero. So if this is horizontally polarized, this has to be vertically polarized. It's like a singlet, like the spin system which has like overall spin zero.
But isn't it like we are already, you know, measuring what which beam is horizontally or which beam.
Oh, but you have the horizontal and vertical polarizers here.
Yeah.
So if this is horizontally polarized, this will automatically be vertically polarized. Sorry. So this is going to affect what's happening here.
D is the eraser, right?
D is the eraser.
You mentioned 8 seconds. Was that with light or with something else?
With light.
The
experiment, the specific experiment which I'm talking about is with light. I think 8 milliseconds? I don't remember the exact picture. But I can give you the reference. It's a very beautiful article. It's a very, I love it. Okay? It has the more, and I'll show you the picture, the actual experimental article. Actually, not the experiment, but the theoretical explanation for the experiment is a beautiful article, I would say. I'll show you pictures of the actual experiments. By the way, this is here, the experimental data which they have. So with DH and DV clicking, you have a Gaussian, which is like a which way. And with DD and D minus D clicking, you have a eraser. Yep.
So these graphs, is that showing what pattern appears on the like the L1 side of it? When like that detector makes a burst?
No. These here, actually, if you go into this, I'm just oversimplifying just to explain the concept, but I can give you a better picture what is actually experimentally being done. Okay, so they had a detector here as well, which they call as D0, and the graphs where which have been plotted here are the coincidence plots. So what this say is that since there's a eight milliseconds or whatever delay, there's a time delay when these detectors are being clicked. So whenever this detector is being clicked, after 8 milliseconds, if this detector is being clicked, so they know that it came from DH. So this is a kind of correlation graph, not the actual pattern, but it gives you the idea that this should work as the quantum eraser, and this should work as the...
So what is the horizontal axis?
Horizontal axis is the number of... So this is the number of clicks, and this is the position. So you have a kind of a moving detector, which moves through the screen. And at each point in space, x, you note, you like, you, OK, maybe I can simplify it by giving step by step. And there might be some experimental details which I'm missing. But the basic idea is as follows. You have photons coming from here, moving here. You have detector, which is like a moving detector. You place the detector here. Your x is 0. You see D0 clicked after 8 milliseconds, which of these clicked. Note the data. You collected data for, like, let's say, some lakhs or something of photons or whatever. Then you move the detector ahead. Your x changes. So this here gives you the x. And this here gives you the number of photons, like number of times this detector clicked when this clicked. OK, so it's kind of coincidence counter, which is being measured. Not exactly the interference pattern here or here. OK, but that was a really good question. Yeah?
So is it correct that the results are only plotted on the plot when the detector DH and DV clicks at the same time as the detector 0 clicks?
Yes. So it's not same time. There's a delay, but yeah.
OK.
The basic concept is right, yeah. OK. Can we move ahead?
Yes.
Before moving ahead, I would say that there's definitely an ambiguity with this thing. Why? Because it defies causality. The effect is happening before the cause. And I won't say that in quantum physics, we are not studying, at this point, we are not studying phenomena which defy causality. But this is definitely not one of those. So there's definitely something wrong with our interpretation. And this is what we are going to see in our tutorial. Okay, we'll get more insights of what is actually happening here. How can we explain this? Okay.
Could you elaborate on
causality? So the pattern which we are getting here is being affected by which marker I'm using, right? If I'm using H and V, I should get a Gaussian, because I know which slit it came from. It's a which way. But if I use H, V, and D, so if the photon chooses to go through H, V, and D, I should get an interference pattern, which is like in quantum eraser. But the decision that I'm using H, V, or H, V, and D, so I'm using which way or quantum eraser, it's being the decision is being taken after the interference pattern has already been produced, because this optical path length is much larger than this. It's much longer. So you are seeing the interference pattern before the decision to use which way and quantum eraser is being made. OK? I had the same reaction.
Okay.
So this is the cause, and this is the effect. But effect is happening before the cause.
It's like the detector over there can see like 8 milliseconds.
It's like it's, yeah, it's sending information in the past. Oh, it's like it already knows where it came from. It came from HV or HVND. So it already knows.
Yeah.
We will have a lot of discussion over this. And I had the similar reaction like this. What? Yeah, yeah. We'll definitely discuss this elaborately in the tutorial, OK?
It probably has something to do with the entanglement. I mean, it won't actually be a paradox when we will see from that perspective.
Yeah, that could be one of the reasons, yes. Let's answer this in tutorials, shall we? I really don't want to kill the suspense, I would say here, okay? Okay, but these are the actual pictures, and the graphs which I took, which I showed you in the previous slide are from, so it's a physical review letters. These are the actual experiments, which look much, much complicated than what I have shown. So much simpler, simplified version. Okay, so what's happening, you could say that the act of measurement, like act of observing the system using these markers, H, V, or D, can affect the particle's behavior, yes. But in this case, it is affecting it retroactively, which means that something is happening to the system even before I have done the measurement on it, okay? And there are a number of ways to interpret this result, or any quantum phenomena, I would say. And all these different interpretations have kind of divided the scientific community into two schools of thoughts, majorly two schools of thoughts. So one is the realist and the other is the orthodox. Orthodox is more aligned to the Copenhagen interpretation. And I'll briefly talk about what these two schools of thoughts are, like how they try to interpret the quantum phenomena, okay? So orthodox view, it talks about probabilities, okay? It says the particle is nowhere, or the particle doesn't have a definite state unless you measure it, okay? That's what the orthodox point of view is. And it's nothing before you do a measurement on it. The act of measurement, not only it affects the system, but it also brings it into existence. So before measurement, it didn't exist anywhere. That's the orthodox point of view. So it's more aligned towards predicting the experimental results rather than trying to answer what is actually happening at quantum realm.
Are we defining measurement as anything that like observes the particle state, or how do we define it?
Excellent question again. So yes, this is exactly which is coming. These are things which came to my mind while I was preparing this, okay? So these are things which I myself have seen for the first time, teaching for the first time. But yes, how do I define measurement? That's a very good question. And that's the kind of open question in physics community, I would say. The way I'm defining measurement here is an act where you cannot retrace the system, something like avalanche. So you disturb the system such that there's no looking back. It's irreversible. That's what how I'm defining here. There may be multiple definitions of how measurement's done. Okay. So it's like, yeah, I think you get the answer. So okay. So this is the orthodox point of view. Talks about probabilities. Good thing, again, it gives you it aligns to the experimental results. It defines how experiments, it tells you, okay, this probabilistic interpretation is going to have your particle land here or something like that. So it's based on probabilistic interpretation, and it gives the experimental, it is able to explain the experimental results very well. But it doesn't go beyond that. It doesn't try to what's actually happening in the quantum realm, how things are working. However, realistic approach is more like trying to understand how quantum phenomena, they actually happen. But again, I would say that both the approaches, they have their own complexities, and which I would say it's just the division between both. I mean, like some people like the realistic point of view, and they say that the uncertainty or the probabilistic nature which orthodox approach is talking about is our ignorance. It's not actual, it's our ignorance, and we need some kind of additional information. So they propose things like hidden variables and other concepts which are not aligned to the orthodox approach in order to explain what's actually happening in the reality. So there are a number of theories like the many world interpretation of quantum world, Bohmian trajectories like this wave pilot theory, and so on. So there are a number of theories which give you the actual phenomena which is happening, which try to explain, or maybe just an attempt to explain what's actually happening in the quantum systems. We have been mostly using orthodox approach, I would say, and that's, I wouldn't say a shame, but at least this approach should have been introduced to us in like in undergrads, at least from where I come in my country. We never talk about these approaches. We always work with the probabilistic approach, like the expectation values, the probability densities, and so on. So this is what we have always been trying to, and that's the picture which has been, I would say, in my mind forever. So I can't go beyond this and think about a realistic person. But there are a few famous scientists, like Einstein was a realist. He believed that quantum theory is not the way it is, it's not complete. We need something else to have a definite answer for quantum world as well. And these are some of the orthodox. And obviously, the school of thoughts have more people in this part of the world, I would say. Like there are few people who believe that there's an underlying quantum phenomena which needs an explanation. Okay, so I'll briefly describe how this Copenhagen interpretation or the orthodox approach, it explains the double slit experiment. It's very simple to say that when you have a source, like say a photon or an electron coming from your source, it moves forwards, and when it is produced from this or fired from that source, it's nowhere. That's what the orthodox approach says. It's like nowhere, and mathematically, you are able to describe it as a wave function. So this concept is just a mathematical conception. There's, you don't have a physical interpretation for this psi. And then when it approaches the slit, it somehow gains the information for both the slits, and mathematically, that is written as superposition of both the slits. So if I normalize it, and after it moves from the slit and it's detected on the screen a measurement is being done, and measurement is the process which gives a physical entity to the system. So the system, which was nowhere, like which was nothing, except for a mathematical description, now is a particle, which you see on the screen. That's what the Copenhagen interpretation or the orthodox views say. So any of you have already heard about these interpretations? Oh, wow, so great. Maybe I can, I am definitely a realist. I am definitely an orthodox, I would say. Maybe the way we have been taught, that matters a lot. I would like to know like which school of thought you belong to. Or you haven't decided yet. Orthodox? Ah.
Isn't the Bell's inequalities like rule out some of the local hidden ripple theories?
Yes. Yes. But still there's a debate. And there's this is a topic which you are going to cover elaborately in Quantum Foundations about different schools of thoughts and all these delayed choices and stuff like that, okay? But yeah, it has. Still, it's a debatable topic. There are so many thoughts which try to explain that as well. Like, for example, I'll say this double slit experiment, the realist, they'll try to explain it. So there's a pilot wave theory with the realistic interpretation which says that there is a quantum particle and it has a guiding wave attached to it. So they believe there's a particle, okay? And it's the guiding wave which interacts with the slits, and that's how the interference pattern is made. But again, then there's complexity that how does the guiding wave interact with the particle and give it information. So there are questions, there are solutions, there are questions. People come up with theories, raise more questions, there are discussions, debates. It's an open area, I would say. And a very interesting one, which I was exposed to when I came here. I didn't know, I knew there are schools of thought which say that quantum theory is incomplete, but the realistic approaches are really nice. If you try to understand them, probably I haven't read about them so much. That's why I'm an orthodox. If I go deep down, I might become a realist, I'd say. So any other realist here? How many orthodox? Most of you, yeah. Any realist?
So like kind of both.
A kind of both. That's a good answer, but why?
Just like orthodox as far as how we describe the systems and everything, but realist in a sense of explanations of what's happening.
So maybe taking like kind of taking good from both.
Yeah.
So orthodox explains the experimental results and realist gives you what's actually happening, something like that, yeah? But you know, with the realists as well, there are theories which try to explain the experimental results. Like this interference pattern, if you draw the Bohmian trajectories with them, you'll exactly see the pattern there with their approach as well. It's not that the realistic approach, they don't align with the experimental results. They do. And with the orthodox approach, what is not explainable is the act of measurement. Like what happens at the act of measurement that the system collapses? There's no theory which actually describes collapse.
I mean, I think the collapse is not physical because the wave function just collapses instantaneously over the entire like Cauchy surface. It's not compatible with relativity.
Can you explain more? So,
like when you measure like if the wave function just collapses, it's over the entire Cauchy surface. It's kind of not compatible with relativity.
Oh, but a Cauchy surface, you said?
It's like an equal time surface over the space time.
Okay, so are you talking about the states over that surface or something like that? Are you trying to give a wave visualization of the wave particle? Is that right? Because I don't believe that it is a wave, actually. Is that, or maybe I misunderstood it?
Can you see if the wave function collapses like faster than the speed of light, right? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, okay.
Instantaneously, right? So
violate
relativity.
Yes. And there are theories like GWR, something like that, which try to explain how collapses they occur. There are theories, but yeah, it happens at a speed of like it happens instantaneously, and instantaneous processes are unexplainable, like the entanglement. It's instantaneous. So there are things which are not explainable, especially with quantum theory. We still have 20 minutes. I can briefly go through the nomenclature which we are going to use in the lectures. Okay, let me. But if the room is open for questions, this was a relatively shorter lecture, it's first day, and I thought it would involve a lot of discussion, and I'm really open to discussion with all these concepts. They are really interesting and thought-provoking. So if any thought you have related to this lecture or anything, I'm really open to that.
And the source for today's experiment, the original paper.
Do you want a hard copy? I have it myself.
No, I mean just a link.
Okay, yeah, I can share through email. I'll write an email. But so you're talking about this, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I can share it by an email after the lectures. I'm going to write an email about today's tutorial. For today's tutorial, you need the mathematical, like you need to know how a Gaussian is represented mathematically. So it's a sine square by delta square form. And how do you mathematically represent interference, which I think you should all be familiar with. Okay.
How is a Gaussian sine squared?
It's actually not a complete Gaussian. It's a diffraction pattern. Oh. And diffraction pattern and the minimas are like spread out. That's why we just say it's kind of Gaussian. The other minimas are really, really small. Excellent. So it's a actually it's a diffraction pattern, not a Gaussian. Okay, so these are some like brief concepts which you all know, but just for the sake of I want to make sure that everybody's on the same picture. So we know that throughout this course, we are mostly going to align with the orthodox view, okay? And we are going to assume that quantum particle is represented by a state vector, which is a mathematical quantity, okay? Represented on a Hilbert space, which is again a theoretical concept. And it can occur in superposition of these states, and these states, if are stationary, which we are going to talk about, what does it mean by stationary? But if they follow the eigenvalue equation, then they are the eigenstates of the system. Okay, it's like the basis of the system, and we are mostly going to talk about bases when we are trying to solve the Schrodinger equation for these systems. Okay, so we are not going to try to solve them completely. We are going to use a basis set approach for that most of the time, yeah. And operators, sometimes I might be missing a cap over them, but you'll probably know that these are operators and they change the state of the system, okay? And this is the dual Ket or Bra system for operators. And I don't know, I don't see a point, really point, but the Hermitian operators would be defined as the operators which are self-adjoint, and they'll have real eigenvalues. And this is how the inner product is going to be defined. And this condition here would mean that they are orthogonal. And if they are normalized, then psi one inner product is going to be one. So this is something basic which you have already done. What is important here is that the measurement on the system, for our part of the course, there are a number of ways to do measurements, but for our part of the course, when we are talking about measurement, we'll usually talk about a projection operator, okay? So this is a projection operator, and we tried to build the postulate of quantum mechanics using our interference patterns. Can you tell how many postulates we actually built? I wasn't able to explain one of the quantum phenomena using this, which I tried hard, but I couldn't. So first was that it's represented as a wave. The second was at the slit, it's represented as the superposition. And then measurement destroys the quantum system. What I really wanted to explain through this was the entanglement, which I couldn't do. And if you look at this part of the, does look like an entanglement, but it's not actually, it's just markers. Okay, so this is something which I couldn't, maybe you can think of some ideas to do that. The room is open for discussion and questions today. And yeah, I really enjoyed the lecture. Probably I should also hand out the forms to you all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Question. Why in that notation, what's psi
S1? Oh, it's the part of the state which is interacting with your slit one.
But that's a vector, right?
That's a vector, yes.
So you've got two vectors in actually
It's I agree, El, yeah. I shouldn't have written it as a composite system because it represents a composite two system, which is not.
Right.
I should probably have used a H marker on top of it. That would have been a better representation.
Okay.
So what it means is that the part of the wave which is interacting with your slit S1
mm-hmm.
is horizontally polarized.
Okay.
So I shouldn't have, but that's how we are going to do the tutorials.
Yeah.
So I really apologize. I shouldn't have done that. That's not the complete.
Yeah.
No, it's not definitely not a composite system.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
It's just the polarization on the system,
yeah.
Of the system.
Yeah.
Yeah.